You're listening to Life in Deep Ellum's podcast.
Yeah. Some good old-fashioned rock and roll by a band named the Texas Gentlemen. Love that song. I don't know if you caught that line, but it said, if you ain't going over the hill, then you're probably going under the knife, and you're still going to have a whole lot of pain in your life. That could preach, right? I mean, I love that song. We just throw Jesus in there, and we can make it a worship song. But before we get too carried away, I need to remember to introduce myself and to cue the ushers. So my name is Mimo Morielli, and I'm the Community Engagement Director here at Life in Deep Ellum. Genuinely happy to be with you all this morning. And we have a tradition of not putting scripture on the screens, so if you don't have a Bible and if you would like one, please raise your hand, and our ushers will bring you one. If you ain't going over the hill, then you're probably going under the knife, and you're still going to have a whole lot of pain in your life. Let that sink in a little bit, because that's part of what we're going to talk about this morning. Pain. It's a fact of life. It's not an option. It's kind of more like a default setting. We are brought into this world through the pain of childbirth, right? And my wife, Gina, especially knows how hard that can be. She had a 51-hour labor. Went for that natural birth, didn't quite get it. C-section, 6 months more of pain, and brought our son into this world. So it's curious that when we picture an ideal life, when we're all picturing the good life, that we don't tend to include pain, right? Like, whose ideal picture of life includes the pain of loss and suffering? Who pictures losing a job? Who pictures broken homes, failure, disappointment? Even small stuff like the commute, right? An hour in traffic every day, or chores. Like, no one pictures that in their ideal picture of life. But I would venture to guess that the problem, the issue is not that life is painful. I think the issue is actually that we don't expect pain. We don't set that up in our expectations of life. We have improper expectations that don't include pain. And I think that's what makes life difficult. And that's what we're going to talk about today. Expectations. Dun, dun, dun. It's a big one. Have you ever thought you were about to drink a Sprite, but it was a club soda? Or, okay, this is going to polarize the room. How many like oatmeal raisin cookies? Raise your hand. Slap yourself with that hand. Because oatmeal raisin cookies are disgusting. And they're deceitful. Yes. I saw this thing one time that said oatmeal raisin cookies are the reason I have trust issues. Yes. And it's true. Like, I'm 32. I always think it's chocolate chip, 100% of the time. Like, if you like oatmeal raisin cookies, I might not let you babysit my kid. Just throwing that out there.
What's the solution then?
What do you mean? The best cookie? I don't know. It's a tough one.
Yeah. Expectations, huh?
Yeah. Why don't, if we're gonna go here, let's just grab the mic. Let's
do it. Testing.
Okay. This is. What, you want to introduce yourself?
I'd love to.
Okay.
Good morning. In case we haven't met yet. My name's Chewy. My wife and I are covenant members here. That's about it.
Cool. So,
here's what my question is for you, Mimo. Okay. Speaking of expectations, you didn't expect this, did you?
No. I didn't.
Let's see where this goes then.
Let's go there.
My first question is, why are we talking about pain in a new year when we have a new series called The Good Life? Shouldn't you start off with something light and fluffy and not a rock video?
I mean, it's going to go somewhere. I just, you know, we're kind of just a couple minutes into it, but you...
I think you should have started with something a little lighter.
Okay.
Maybe a joke.
People were laughing at the oatmeal raisin bit was pretty good,
yeah.
I thought. See?
Yeah.
Kathleen liked it.
Let me try it.
Okay.
You have no idea what's coming, do you? I'm a school teacher, and so I usually start class with a joke.
Okay.
For instance, at school, what is a cow's favorite subject?
Music.
That's a good one. Music. I haven't heard that before. Not the answer for me, though. Calculus.
Oh.
I got one more. You ready?
Yeah.
What do you call a cow with no legs? Ground beef.
Nice.
Some of you knew that. What do you call a cow with two legs?
Lean beef.
Get it? Leaning. Got it. You could have done that, or instead of your rock band video that none of us have heard of, you could have played a cool video.
You got a video?
I do.
Okay.
A fun video.
This is weird. If this was totally spontaneous, how did you get a video?
I got it right here.
Up?
Don't worry.
Oh, you're going to play it from your phone.
I got
okay.
it. Don't worry.
All right.
Here we go. See what I mean?
Yeah, that was good.
Lots of more laughter.
Yeah, that's true.
So here's my point. Being a new year and a new series, mm-hmm. You got a lot to follow up after Rachel's sermon last week.
It's true.
Big shoes to fill. Joel's out. So I guess I would say... my expectations are higher
okay.
than to talk about pain and oatmeal cookies.
All right. Is that all?
I want you to bring it today.
Okay. I'm going to try. I appreciate you kind of being forthcoming, though, instead of sending me an email later. I really do.
We're going to start at the beginning yeah. here, and there'll be more later.
Okay. Well, all right.
My expectations are high.
All right. Chewy Matouche. Thank you. They are big shoes to fill. I did wear plaid, try to channel my inner Joel, let my beard grow out a little bit. So before, like I was trying to say with the oatmeal raisin cookie tangent, that's actually not the kind of expectations we're going to talk about today. Because this isn't the kind of church that you can get away with a fluffy New Year's sermon about expectations. This is the kind of church well-versed in the hard stuff. In having our expectations unmet, sometimes shattered. I think improper expectations is kind of one of the threads that brings a lot of us to Life in Deep Ellum. Somebody else, maybe ourselves, set expectations about life and faith and God, and those were found to not be in line with reality. So many of us came to this church jaded, a little cynical. Most of us, I know a lot of stories. We've been through some hard stuff in life, right? But the main thing I want us to see this morning is that even in that place, even when our biggest expectations are unmet, even in the middle of the hard stuff, when we grow in gratitude, we can be content in all circumstances. So we're going to go into our Bibles real quick. Philippians 4. It's going to be in verse 10. It's right after Ephesians. Philippians 4, verse 10. I rejoiced greatly in the Lord that at last you renewed your concern for me. Indeed, you were concerned, but had no opportunity to show it. I'm not saying this because I'm in need, for I've learned to be content in whatever circumstances. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I've learned the secret of being content in every and any situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. I can do all this through him who gives me strength. So even though my hope today is that this sermon ends up being extremely practical for everybody, I do think it's important to touch on a little bit of context. When reading scripture, it's always important for us to remember that we read scripture with our own assumptions, with our own cultural lens and our own context that's always going to be a little bit different or a lot different than the one it was written in. In this passage, Paul is encouraging his friends at the church in Philippi. Paul was in prison, and in their culture, in prison, your provisions came from the outside. Other people had to provide for you. The prisons weren't serving three meals a day. Sometimes they weren't serving any meals a day. So Paul is not talking about missing a snack and being a little hangry. He's talking about real hunger. And he's clarifying here that he doesn't currently have a need. He's not asking more from the Philippians, but he was grateful for them. And in fact, he says he's learned the secret to be content in all circumstances. So this is what Paul's saying. I'm content no matter what. Sit me down at a big feast where I leave with leftovers. Put me in prison with no food. I'm good. It's all good. Like, that's what he's saying, and that's really real, right? So a little more context. Let's now flip over to 2 Corinthians. 1 and 2 Corinthians, right after Acts and Romans. We're going to be 11, starting at verse 24. And this is where Paul's accounting some of the hardships he's faced on his missionary journeys. Verse 24. 5 times I received from the Jews the 40 lashes minus one, which is talking about being whipped. 3 times I was beaten with rods. 1 I was pelted with stones. 3 I was shipwrecked. I spent a night and a day in the open sea. I've been constantly on the move. I've been in danger from rivers, in danger from bandits, in danger from my fellow Jews, in danger from Gentiles, in danger in the city, in danger in the country, in danger at sea, and in danger from false believers. I have labored and toiled and have often gone without sleep. I have known hunger and thirst and have often gone without food. I have been cold and naked. Besides everything else, I face the daily pressure of my concern for all the churches. So I wanted to set the Philippians passage in the context of the 2 Corinthians passage because I think it's vital that we don't let our own jaded view of Scripture cause us to miss the point here. Paul isn't talking about first world problems, and that's not what we're talking about in this series either. We're talking about real life hardship and a Christian vision for being content in all circumstances. Paul is actually the same guy who authored what Rachel gave us as our vision for the good life last week. If you don't remember, that was rejoice always, pray continually, give thanks in all circumstances, for this is God's will for you in Christ Jesus. Rejoice always, pray continually, give thanks in all circumstances. So why is it that Paul can talk about being content in all circumstances? Like, he says it's through Christ, right? But he also says he learned the secret to being content. I think it's because in Paul's life, through practicing gratitude and through the grace of Christ, that allows him to keep a holy vision of the good life. And I think the same can be true for us. When we grow in gratitude, we can be content in all circumstances. That's our big picture here. So let me pause and provide a little roadmap for where we're going to go this morning. It is going to be practical, but we have to get through some stuff first. So first, we're going to talk about we all have a vision of the good life, and that vision sets our expectations. Then we're going to talk about how when that vision gets torn apart, we can move toward gratitude or entitlement. And then finally, to grow in gratitude, we must practice it. I was talking to a buddy last night, and he was like, oh, so what are you preaching on? I was like, I'm working on a sermon right now. I'm like, oh, I'm preaching on expectations. And he's like, oh, that should be easy. And this was after like 3 days of sermon prep. I'm like, okay, how so? He's like, have none. That's your sermon. And like, I think I would give that advice too. I actually like went down that rabbit trail when I first started considering like, okay, I'm preaching on expectations. What does that look like? But that's false advice, you know, because we're all going to have expectations no matter what. Even if we shift them, we can adapt, we can grow to be people that can handle interruptions and pains and disappointments, but we're never not going to have expectations. So I wanted to start by focusing on what forms our vision of the good life that then sets our expectations. There was a time in my life where I was basically living in what I perceived to be the good life. It was when Gene and I were about to get married, and I felt like we were called to be missionaries in the Philippines. And so I prayed a very specific prayer with a very, like there's one way this prayer is going to get confirmation, God, because this is a big thing you're asking. And the confirmation happened, and then we had to raise a pretty large amount of money in a short span of time, and that happened. So it was like further confirmation, okay, we're tracking, we're on the right road. And when we were in the Philippines, even though it was really hard, we were doing like kind of a business as missions model. So we were growing a business and a ministry from scratch at the same time, and that was really hard. But because I really felt like I was fulfilling God's call on my life, I felt like this is it. I'm living in the good life. And there was even the day when I got home from teaching a discipleship course with our interns, and I was like on cloud nine, and I walk in and I'm like, Gene, if you died today, do you feel like you would have fulfilled everything God asked you to do? And then she was like, no. You know, because like, who says that and who actually thinks that? And I was like, oh, well, I do, you know, like I was like, this is it, we're doing it. So I was in my vision of the good life. There's a book that we are reading to kind of frame this series called Desiring the Kingdom. And in that book, the author, James K.A. Smith, he kind of says it like this. What we love is a specific vision of the good life, an implicit picture of what we think human flourishing looks like. And his big argument in the beginning of the book is that we humans are not primarily thinking creatures. I think, therefore I am. He also says he doesn't believe that we're even primarily believing creatures or religious creatures, but that we're primarily lovers. We're creatures of desire, and that what we love is what we'll worship, which will form us as well as our vision of the good life. Here's my picture of the good life. Just kind of a little representation there. So that guy's imagining himself. He's got a beautiful wife, good lips. Lots of kids, so there's babies all around, a couple bags of money. Those aren't pineapples. So that represents financial security. He's got a big house, a little thumbs up, so he's doing good at work. That says nice work. And his gravestone says 1985 to 2085, so he lived a good long life. I think we all have our own personalized version of this, right, if we tried to draw it out on a little piece of paper. Unfortunately, though, our vision of the good life isn't necessarily something that we always choose to believe or craft. Actually, I think most of the time it's something that's crafted for us. And Smith adds about this, we're talking about ultimate loves, that to which we are fundamentally oriented, the ultimate desires that shape us and position us and make sense of our other desires and actions. It also isn't something that we're necessarily aware of. I think it's actually more like DNA. It's embedded deep down into the core of who we are. Like Nacho Libre said, beneath the clothes, we find a man. Beneath the man, we find his nucleus. So at our core, I think there's really three things that have a foundational influence on what we think is a vision of the good life. And when I say we, I mean us here in Dallas, Texas, America, 2018. The pursuit of happiness, consumerism, and our particular religious upbringing. I think those are the three things that kind of set our expectations for the good life before we're even thinking about them. For us, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness seems to be more than a mere slogan, but an extremely foundational assumption about human flourishing. Think about it. These are the words and ideas that fueled the revolution and the building of one of the greatest nations the world has ever seen. Not a small thing, right? In our case, I think the vision of the good life was particularly influenced by this idea of the pursuit of happiness. So I'm not saying that happiness is wrong or that pursuing liberty and justice for all, or life and liberty for all, is a bad thing either, hasn't led to good things. But this morning, we're kind of focusing on what shaped our most core allegiance, right? So what are some things that might be included in the pursuit of happiness? Comfort, ease, abundance, pleasure, leisure, security, success. Can you see how these things, when turned into ultimate ideals and foundational personal values, can set improper expectations? There's no room for pain. There's no room for difficulty, character building, disappointment. So now pair that with the values of consumerism. From day one, we're taught that happiness, the thing that we are meant to pursue, can be found in the consumption of products and experiences. We're taught to love and lust after what is new and to despise what is old. Good consumers buy things. They buy things when they feel good. They buy things when they feel bad. They buy things when they're bored, right? When they have time to kill, they go shopping. Consumers have very little patience for things that aren't easy, pleasurable, or immediately at their disposal. So it's a bitter pill to swallow, but consumerism is also an integral part of who we are as people, simply as a result of our context. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness fleshes out and matures in consumerism, of which we are all disciples, like it or not. These things then bolster and encourage any baptized iterations of themselves. So this is what I'm saying. It's after we have learned to value the pursuit of happiness, and after we have found our identity as consumers, that we then start to add religious beliefs. And then I think what happens is sometimes what we deem as Christian are really just rebranded versions of American values. Now, I really don't think that this means that all of our values are only American and not Christian. I don't want to send anyone into a crisis of faith this morning. I just think we have to be critical of it. Our religious upbringing definitely constitutes a core part of who we are. But sometimes even those religious beliefs, the things that we think about God, set improper expectations about who God really is. And we find that deep down, our beliefs are actually a little bit different. We have some different expectations about the good life and about what God is going to do in our lives. And I want to kind of illustrate that with a little bit more of my story. So this picture represents my new, slightly adjusted vision of the good life. This is the core leadership team for the missions project in the Philippines. And since my faith is a big part of who I am, I was kind of able to make some adjustments. You know, moving to the Philippines, I'd do without some creature comforts. This is actually in front of a Starbucks. So we weren't necessarily living in a very remote part of the world. But I had to give up some ideas. But ultimately, I still felt like I was living the good life because I felt like I was pursuing what God wanted me to do. And that was kind of the reality. But midway through, there was kind of this turning point. And our business didn't take off the way that we thought it would. And I started to get a little bit burnt out. And I was operating, there was one point where I was just operating out of pure stress. So I was being really hurtful to the interns that we were trying to grow and develop, which were the people that we moved halfway around the world to serve. And then Gina got hit with some really intense anxiety, so much so that she couldn't work anymore. And there was a night where she was even confused about who I was, like she didn't know who I was. And there was a split second that she didn't know where she was. And so that caused us to move back to Dallas sooner than we had planned. So it kind of felt like this anti-missionary story. And then a couple months after we were back in Dallas, two of those core team members, Matthew and Haley, died suddenly in a car accident. And Matthew was the CEO, and he was kind of the brains of the entrepreneur side of everything. And so that ultimately set our ministry on the course to struggle and ultimately fizzle out, and it also left this huge gap in our hearts and a lot of pain. And by this time, we were pretty worn out. We had just moved back to Dallas, so even though our vision of the good life was torn, you know, we thought we were going to set up this big ministry. We thought that we were going to move back, even though it was a little bit early, and our friends were just going to carry the torch, and everything was going to be great. But it's almost like if you took that picture and just ripped it. Our vision of the good life was torn, but we had to move forward. So we were back in Dallas, and it was kind of a little bit of a two-year process, but Gina really miraculously got over the anxiety without getting on antidepressants, which was really great. We both settled back in and got jobs, developed some really key relationships, and we were back as part of this faith community, and I started growing and getting stronger and healing as well. But it definitely started, it felt like starting over. But then, 3 years after that, something really unexpected happened. It was a Wednesday night, and we were getting ready for life group, and my mom called me hysterical and said that my brother had been diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. So I expected life to go a certain way, or at least not to go a certain way. In part because of this deeply rooted expectation that I had some kind of deal with God. And of course, this wasn't part of my cognitive thought. This was part of my desires, right? Of course, I didn't think that God owed me anything for what I did for him. But I still found that deep down, that in light of what I had done, being a moral person, being faithful to the church, following a missionary calling, that God would at least be obligated not to completely wreck my life, right? Like, I really believe that. When my vision of the good life was torn, I found that at the core, I believed that God owed me something. And in my pain and my confusion and my grief, I started to see this growing entitlement towards God. So through the process of trying to make sense of this all and grow, I've come to believe that when it comes to unmet expectations, that we're on this spectrum of gratitude and entitlement. When our vision of the good life gets torn apart, when our expectations of God and life in general are unmet, we have a choice to move towards gratitude or entitlement. So I took the liberty of making a graph of what I'm talking about here. So we have our expectations that are set, and life is moving along just fine, and then bam, disappointment. I think that the disappointment then serves as a juncture point. And we can either move in our life towards gratitude or towards entitlement. I honestly think that this is a good depiction of what happens when we have unmet expectations, even in the big stuff, also in the small stuff. And I would put grief kind of right there as the avenue that moves us toward entitlement or gratitude. Unhealthy processing or the avoidance of grief will likely always lead us into entitlement. But notice that grieving and gratitude are not mutually exclusive. It's actually in engaging in healthy forms of grieving that we move toward gratitude. And when Rachel and I were talking about this week, when we were going over the sermon, she kind of had this picture of a disappointment kind of throwing us into the open waters of grief. And from there, it's sink or swim. Sink down into entitlement and pain and self-pity, or start swimming toward the dry land of gratitude and strength. So this is the spectrum of entitlement and gratitude. Very scientific. Pre-Philippines, I thought that I was about here, pretty close to the gratitude end of the spectrum. And now that I look back on my reaction to different things in my life, I think I was actually probably more towards the middle. Not super close to entitlement, but also not super close to gratitude. Seeing how I reacted to certain things, it was kind of just like, as long as God didn't screw up too much, I was happy. But then in 2016, when my brother was diagnosed with cancer and ultimately lost his battle in a matter of months, I was flung way over to that entitlement side. God had taken more than his fair share. And I deserve better. My brother deserved better. How is this going to make anyone in my family happy? Doesn't God know that the pursuit of happiness has no room for pain? That was really the space I was living in. Since then, I've done a lot of hard personal work, and I honestly think I'm probably closer to the middle again. Not trying to be too naive about where I stand in entitlement, but also giving myself a little credit, moving towards gratitude, softening up a little bit, and kind of receiving life as a gift from God again. So that's my story, and that's enough of my story. Right now, I want you guys to try to apply this to your own life. So I've got two questions for you. The first one, how has your vision of the good life been torn? What disappointments did you bring in with you today? What disappointments are you kind of sitting in and having to deal with? And the second question is, where are you on the spectrum of entitlement and gratitude? Are you sinking? Are you swimming? So take a minute to consider those. Maybe you can draw a little spectrum for yourself on your note sheet. How has your vision of the good life been torn? Where are you on the spectrum of gratitude and entitlement? Entitlement might be hard to detect in ourselves, because if you remember the first graph, it typically won't be until we're met with a disappointment that we find out where we actually are on this spectrum. There's an ancient proverb that I have on my computer that says, whatever you're overflowing with will spill out when you're bumped. That's good. So maybe a good question is, how do you tend to react when there's a disappointment in your life? Like, big or small, how do you react to that? That might be really telling on where you are on the spectrum. I'm going to read that quote again because I got some ums. whatever you are overflowing with will spill over when you're bumped. So we can't, thank you. So we can flesh that out a little more by considering what it looks like to be an entitled person or a grateful person. So what does an entitled person look like? Well, their most basic assumption is that God or life owes them something, probably grumpy, maybe a little selfish, probably a little rude, at least when their expectations aren't met, and they're not getting their way. They reject reality, closed off to God because God can't be trusted, and probably uses people. The entitled person, in their pursuit of getting what they deserve, will usually view people as either allies or enemies. Either way, life is all about me. So these are the generic ideas, but I think they can help us all kind of identify our own stinky brand of entitlement. You might not identify with all of them, but hopefully they'll lead you towards seeing where you're entitled with your life. So what does a grateful person look like? Well, I think that video of the kid getting the banana is probably a pretty perfect picture of like pure gratitude, right? He got a gift, and he gets to bring it home, and he's really excited about that. The grateful person's most basic assumption is that everything is a gift. They're cheerful, generous, kind, accepts reality, even when reality doesn't meet their expectations. They're open to God because they trust that God has their best interests in mind, and they're life-giving to others. And if we want to live in this space, if we want to become people of gratitude, I think we really can, and we can expect to grow in that. But we have to consistently practice growing in gratitude. To live and grow in gratitude, we have to practice it. So, the last part of the sermon, I'm going to try to give you guys some practical advice on how to grow in gratitude. And I don't know that all of these will connect with every single one of you, but my hope is that you can take one of the things that I give this morning and try to apply it in your life this week. Cool? All right, so the first thing that I'm going to suggest that will really help you grow in gratitude is prayer. Prayer? I thought this was supposed to be practical. Here's the thing. Prayer is practical. If you question the practicality of prayer, I would ask you, are you praying? And not in a judgmental way, really just in defense of prayer as this time-tested and foundational way to change our hearts and see God move in our lives. I really like the way that the 12 and 12 from Alcoholics Anonymous puts it. This is step 11, prayer and meditation. It says, we recoiled from meditation and prayer as obstinately as the scientist who refused to perform a certain experiment lest it prove his theory wrong. Of course, we finally did experiment, and when unexpected results followed, we felt different. In fact, we knew different. And so we were sold on meditation and prayer. And that, we found, can happen to anybody who tries. It has been well said that almost the only scoffers at prayer are those who never tried it enough. Those of us who have come to make regular use of prayer would no more do without it than we would refuse air, food, or sunshine, and for the same reason. When we refuse air, light, or food, the body suffers. And when we turn away from meditation and prayer, we likewise deprive our minds, our emotions, and our intuitions of vitally needed support. Love me some 12-step wisdom. Where are my addicts at? Boom. Again, I'm being no more judgmental here than if I told you guys to eat. Prayer is kind of one of the non-negotiables of pastoring. Because prayer is that vital to growth in our lives and our connection with God. It really is. But the thing about prayer is that there's not just one way to pray. Prayer is a thing that can take on many forms. So if a form of prayer isn't working for you right now, I want to encourage you guys, don't feel like you need to muscle through it. And don't assume that it's because you're doing something wrong. Just drop the form and take on another one. The thing is to pray. So here are some ways that you can pray, some practical things, some forms, rather. You can do a simple prayer. This is a simple, unfiltered prayer to God, bringing all of your thoughts and emotions without a filter. God can handle all of it. You can vent. If you're going through something really hard and you haven't brought it before God yet, you really should, because he can handle it. He can take it, and he actually wants you to come to him with your pain. Because if you don't come to him with your pain, how can he get the permission to heal it? Venting to God is a great way to pray. You can journal your prayers. You can pray the daily examine, which Rachel is very well versed in. Or you can use a written prayer that stood the test of time. For me, a prayer that's actually become very practical and workable in my life is the Serenity Prayer. I didn't have time to include it in the sermon, so if you want to ask me about it later, I'd be happy to tell you about it. But that's a pre-written prayer. It didn't come from my heart, but it's worked itself into my life. You can get active. You can go on a hike or a run or a bike ride and pray. You can think. You can practice meditation or contemplation, which a lot of times looks more like a centering. You can pray while listening to worship music. You can even pray while doing the dishes. It's true. The point is that there's lots of ways to pray, and the important thing is prayer itself, not getting hung up on certain forms. And again, I want to emphasize that I'm giving you guys a practice today, so that means you have to do it more than once, right? If you make prayer your habit, if you make it a lifestyle, that's where you tap into the true power of prayer. That's where you grow in acceptance. And this isn't about, it really isn't about quantity, though. Does that make sense? It's not about quality either, I don't think, because if it was about both of those, if it was about quantity or quality, then we could do it wrong. I think it's really just about regularity. When we make it a part of our life, we're living it. It's our habit, and it's actually part of our heart. One last note on prayer is posture. If we're entering into prayer as a way of changing our attitudes and expectations, we shouldn't underestimate the power of posture. And again, what I mean is if you kneel when you pray or you put your hands out or whatever. Here, there's also a lot of things you could do, and one is not necessarily more important than the other. But when you intentionally add a posture to your prayer, I think it will add a lot of power to your prayer life. So that's prayer. That's the first thing that will help us grow in gratitude. The second thing that I think will help us grow in gratitude is to revel in the good stuff. In the Christian tradition, this is also called the discipline of celebration. So if we're thinking about this in terms of a practice, maybe this week you revel in the good stuff. If something is really good, you just say it out loud. Or if you're having fun with friends, you just say, "Hey, I'm having a really good time." That can be a small way to practice reveling in the good stuff, and I really think that you'll find yourself growing in gratitude. One of my favorite examples of this idea is from a book called Patched Together by an author named Brennan Manning. It's a fictional story about this guy named Willy Wan. He's a little boy. He lives in a town called Hopi. And as a boy, he got into an accident that left him with a lot of scars on his face, also left him with a pretty bad limp. And so a festival came to his town, and he went into one of the performance tents, and he saw this guy who they called the Medicine Man. And when he walked into the tent, the Medicine Man said, "Hello, little brother. I've been waiting for you. I hoped you would come in today," which was a very different reaction than Willy Wan was used to experiencing from people. Usually people recoiled from him. So the Medicine Man befriended Willy Wan, and pretty quick into reading, you realize that the Medicine Man is actually Jesus. And in my favorite part of the book, Willy Wan and the Medicine Man are hanging out, and Willy Wan offers to share his fajita with him. And the Medicine Man laughed and accepted the gift. And then it says, Willy Wan split the fajita carefully, handing half to the Medicine Man, who ate with great gusto. In fact, the Medicine Man attacked the food with such single-minded relish, licking his fingers and smacking his lips, that Willy Wan had watched in amazement. Aware of his rapt attention, the Medicine Man said, "When you get to heaven, little friend, which is where I live, Abba will not ask you how many prayers you said or how many souls you saved. No. He'll ask, 'Did you enjoy the fajita?'" He wants you to live with passion in the beauty of the moment, accepting and enjoying his gifts. That might be my all-time favorite depiction of Jesus. This is what reveling in the good stuff looks like. It's getting in the habit of celebrating big things and small things. It's living with passion and in the beauty of the moment, accepting all of God's good gifts to us. So the next time you find yourself being a little grumpy or ungrateful, just imagine going to heaven and God saying, "Did you enjoy the fajita?" And you're going to smile. And then you're going to go eat Mexican food. Which is literally Friday night after working on my sermon, I was like, Gina, I have to go get fajitas. We did. It was delicious. So to grow in gratitude, we can pray. We can revel in the good stuff. We can grow in celebration. The last thing I want to talk about is reframing our vision. If we find that our vision of the good life constantly sets up our expectations and is constantly leaving us with disappointments, it's time for a reframing. When I found out that my brother had stage 4 cancer, the first feelings that I experienced was anger. My brother had a particularly hard life. As a child, he had alopecia, which is a disease where you lose all your hair, and in a lot of cases, the hair doesn't completely grow back. That's what happened to Terry. So that subjected him to a lifetime of bullying from kids and adults. A lot of people were quick to use the word freak. And then on my brother's 10th birthday, his biological father decided that he didn't want a family anymore, and he left. And my brother also experienced a lot of financial hardship, which was partly of his own making. Still, pretty hard. Then he had the death of a child, and then his first marriage failed. So at that time, after his first marriage failed, he was about 30, and he decided to move back home. And he started to pick up the pieces of his life. Stopped borrowing from payday lenders, started working a consistent job, even met and married his second wife, Robin, who gave him 2 kids, Mary Jane and Dylan. And then a few years later, probably about 7 years, he eventually moved to Grove, Oklahoma, to be closer to our parents. And while he was living there, he worked a couple of jobs that weren't really that good of a fit, and then he finally landed this job as a 911 dispatcher in the Grove Police Department. Which turned out to be a really great job for him. And he had also become really involved in his church. He was really active in the kids' department. And everybody loved him. He was in the best place of his life. And then he got cancer. So my immediate reaction was like, great. So Terry's finally at a good place in his life, and he gets cancer. Good storyline. I was really mad. I didn't understand, and the disappointment drove me deep into a resentment toward God and an inner life of entitlement. It just flat out didn't make sense, and I wasn't happy with God. A year and a half later, today, I still don't understand. I don't understand why God allowed my brother to die at the age of 43. Probably never will. But during the weekend of his passing, God changed my perspective a little bit. While grieving with my family and watching my brother slowly and painfully fade away, I saw the entire Grove Police Department come by to pay their respects, and almost all of Grove's first responders. And I saw... I really thought I wasn't going to cry on this one. I don't know why. I saw people from their church bring every meal we needed. I saw people from my parents' neighborhood bring a recliner so my brother could be more comfortable. On the day of his funeral, the fire department erected a giant American flag between 2 ladders. Like, it was huge. And the police department gave my sister-in-law and my niece and nephew a police escort. And on the day of the funeral, it was packed. The church had about a 300 seating capacity, and every seat was taken. People were there to honor him, and God helped reframe my vision. Yes, Terry was in the best place of his life when he died. And what more could any of us want than that? He died with dignity and honor, surrounded by a loving community. When Gina and I were up there one of the weekends, I was kind of interviewing him, and Gina asked if Terry was afraid to die. And he said no, because he had no regrets. He really felt fully reconciled to God and everyone in his life. So God changed my perspective a little bit. I still don't understand it. I still deal with pain and grief over his loss. But on the other side of it, I can look at Terry's death with gratitude, trusting that God knows what he's doing. And I can look at my own life with gratitude, thankful to have had a loving big brother who made me who I am. Thankful to have lived in the Philippines and worked my dream job, because who else can say that? Thankful to be back in Dallas, part of a beautiful faith community like this one. My situation hasn't really changed, but I can honestly say that through growing in gratitude, I have learned to be content with my life. This is pretty real for me, and I think it can be real for you guys. So that's my best advice on how to grow in gratitude. And hopefully there was something for you guys to take away today, so the next time a disappointment hits, gratitude has become your habit, and you won't find yourself thrust into entitlement. Because when we grow in gratitude, we can learn to be content in all circumstances. I really believe that. You got something else to say?
Maybe I do.
Okay.
But I don't know how to try and be funny after that.
I know. I'm sorry.
What a story this morning, right? Thank you for sharing, Nemo. Mm-hmm. It's not how I would have done it, talking about expectations in a new year. But I think you really brought it, brother.
Thank you.
And I'm thankful that you get to share that with us. Can you handle closing this?
Man, I don't know. I think I can.
I think you need the practice. Why don't you try?
Okay.
But I have a suggestion.
All right.
While I was sitting here, I thought, I didn't know that you had a sassy voice like that. The prayer part. Can you do it one more time for
prayer?
Us?
Prayer? Mm-hmm. I thought this was supposed to be practical. That's me imagining y'all's thoughts, by the way. That's what I imagine.
I would love you to do your benediction in that voice.
Oh, my goodness.
And change everyone's expectations.
Well, I still don't have a benediction, actually, truth be told.
What are you going to do then?
I'm going to pray, because that's what you do. And then I'm just going to wing it.
Here's to expectations. Go get them.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. Give it up for Chewy. Our personification of expectations and entitlement. He did a pretty good job.
I don't know if I'm supposed to go sit down. I didn't practice that.
Whatever.
I'm going to stay
Why
right
don't
here.
You sit? We'll both sit. All right, let me pray. God, I thank you for this community. I thank you that you not only give us your revelation in the form of Scripture, but you also reveal to us the tools on how to work out our faith. God, I pray this morning that in the small things that lead to big attitudes and in the big things that completely destroy us, God, that we can learn to be content, that we can move, sometimes incrementally, closer to that vision of the good life, that we can find ourselves rejoicing and praying and giving thanks to you in all circumstances, God. I pray that over this faith community, and I thank you for being in our lives, and I thank you for being a part of the church that makes space for processing and understands spectrums. And I pray that this week you would just walk with us and help us to grow closer to you. In Jesus' name, amen. If you ain't going over the hill, you're probably going under the knife, and you're still going to have a whole lot of pain in your life. Have a great Sunday.